Chapter 26. Hong Kong. The deep psychological appeal of games, which are really just a series of increasingly difficult challenges, is the belief that they can be won. Nowhere is this more clear to me than in the case of the Rubik's Cube, which satisfies a universal fantasy that if you just work hard enough and twist yourself through all the possibilities, everything in the world that appears scrambled and incoherent will finally click into position and become perfectly aligned. That human ingenuity is enough to transform the most broken and chaotic system into something logical and orderly, where every face of three-dimensional space shines with perfect uniformity. I'd had a plan, I'd had multiple plans, in which a single mistake would have meant getting caught. And yet I hadn't been. I'd made it out of the NSA, I'd made it out of the country. I had beaten the game. By every standard I could imagine, the hard part was over. But my imagination hadn't been good enough, because the journalists I'd asked to come meet me weren't showing up. They kept postponing, giving excuses, apologizing. I knew that Laura Poitras, to whom I'd already sent a few documents and the promise of many more, was ready to fly anywhere from New York City at a moment's notice. But she wasn't going to come alone. She was busy trying to get Glenn Greenwald to commit, trying to get him to buy a new laptop that he wouldn't put online, trying to get him to install encryption programs so we could better communicate. And there I was, in Hong Kong, watching the clock tick away the hours, watching the calendar tick off the days, beseeching, begging, please come before the NSA realizes I've been gone from work too long. It was tough to think about all the lengths I'd gone to only to face the prospect of being left in Hong Kong high and dry. I tried to work up some sympathy for these journalists who seemed too busy or too nervous to lock down their travel plans. But then I'd recall just how little of the material for which I was risking everything would actually make it to the public if the police arrived first. I thought about my family and Lindsay, and how foolish it was to have put my life in the hands of people who didn't even know my name. I barricaded myself in my room at the Mira Hotel, which I chose because of its central location in a crowded shopping and business district. I put the "Privacy, please do not disturb" sign on the door handle to keep housekeeping out. For 10 days, I didn't leave the room for fear of giving a foreign spy the chance to sneak in and bug the place. With the stakes so high, the only move I had was to wait. I converted the room into a poor man's operations center, the invisible heart of the network of encrypted internet tunnels from which I'd send increasingly shrill pleas to the absent emissaries of our free press. Then I'd stand at the window, hoping for a reply, looking out onto the beautiful park I'd never visit. By the time Laura and Glenn finally arrived, I'd eaten every item on the room service menu. That isn't to say that I just sat around during that week and a half writing wheedling messages. I also tried to organize the last briefing I'd ever give, going through the archive, figuring out how best to explain its contents to the journalists in the surely limited time we'd have together. It was an interesting problem, how to most cogently express to non-technical people who were almost certainly inclined to be skeptical of me the fact that the U.S. government was surveilling the world and the methods by which it was doing so. I put together dictionaries of terms of art, like metadata and communications bearer. I put together glossaries of acronyms and abbreviations, CCE, CSS, DNI, NOFORN. I made the decision to explain not through technologies or systems, but through surveillance programs, in essence, through stories, in an attempt to speak their language. But I couldn't decide which stories to give them first, and I kept shuffling them around, trying to put the worst crimes in the best order. I had to find a way to help at least Laura and Glenn understand something in the span of a few days that it had taken me years to puzzle out. Then there was another thing. I had to help them understand who I was and why I'd decided to do this. At long last, Glenn and Laura showed up in Hong Kong on June 2nd. When they came to meet me at the Mira, I think I disappointed them, at least initially. They even told me as much, or Glenn did. He'd been expecting someone older, some chain-smoking, tipsy depressive with terminal cancer and a guilty conscience. He didn't understand how a person as young as I was, he kept asking me my age, not only had access to such sensitive documents, but was also willing to throw his life away. For my part, I didn't know how they could have expected some graybeard, given my instructions to them about how to meet, go to a certain quiet alcove by the hotel restaurant furnished with an alligator skin-looking pleather couch, and wait around for a guy holding a Rubik's Cube. The funny thing was that I'd originally been wary of using that bit of tradecraft, but the cube was the only thing I'd brought with me that was likely to be unique and identifiable from a distance. It also helped me hide the stress of waiting for what I feared might be the surprise of handcuffs. That stress would reach its visible peak just 10 or so minutes later, when I'd brought Laura and Glenn up to my room, number 1014, on the 10th floor. Glenn had barely had the chance to stow his smartphone in my minibar fridge at my request when Laura started rearranging and adjusting the lights in the room. Then she unpacked her digital video camera. Though we'd agreed over encrypted email that she could film our encounter, I wasn't ready for the reality. Nothing could have prepared me for the moment when she pointed her camera at me, sprawled out on my unmade bed in a cramped, messy room that I hadn't left for the past 10 days. I think everybody has had this kind of experience. The more conscious you are of being recorded, the more self-conscious you become. Merely the awareness that there is or might be somebody pressing record on their smartphone and pointing it at you can cause awkwardness, even if that somebody is a friend. Though today, nearly all of my interactions take place via camera, I'm still not sure which experience I find more alienating, seeing myself on film or being filmed. I try to avoid the former, but avoiding the latter is now difficult for everyone. In a situation that was already high intensity, I stiffened. The red light of Laura's camera, like a sniper's sight, kept reminding me that at any moment the door might be smashed in and I'd be dragged off forever. And whenever I wasn't having that thought, I kept thinking about how this footage was going to look when it was played back in court. I realized there were so many things I should have done, like putting on nicer clothes and shaving. Room service plates and trash had accumulated throughout the room. There were noodle containers and half-eaten burgers, piles of dirty laundry and damp towels on the floor. It was a surreal dynamic. Not only had I never met any filmmakers before being filmed by one, I had never met any journalists before serving as their source. The first time I ever spoke aloud to anyone about the U.S. government's system of mass surveillance, I was speaking to everyone in the world with an internet connection. In the end, though, regardless of how rumpled I looked and stilted I sounded, Laura's filming was indispensable, because it showed the world exactly what happened in that hotel room in a way that newsprint never could. The footage she shot over the course of our days together in Hong Kong can't be distorted. Its existence is a tribute not just to her professionalism as a documentarian, but to her foresight. I spent the week between June 3rd and June 9th cloistered in that room with Glenn and his colleague from The Guardian, Ewan McCaskill, who joined us a bit later that first day. We talked and talked, going through the NSA's programs, while Laura hovered and filmed. In contrast to the frenetic days, the nights were empty and desolate. Glenn and Ewan would retreat to their own hotel, the nearby W, to write up their findings into articles. Laura would disappear to edit her footage and to do her own reporting with Bart Gellman of the Washington Post, who never made it to Hong Kong, but worked remotely with the documents he received from her. I'd sleep, or try to, or else I'd put on the TV, find an English language channel like the BBC or CNN, and watch the international reaction. On June 5th, The Guardian broke Glenn's first story, the FISA court order that authorized the NSA to collect information from the American telecom Verizon about every phone call it handled. On June 6th, it ran Glenn's Prism story, pretty much simultaneously with a similar account in the Washington Post by Laura and Bart. I knew, and I think we all knew, that the more pieces came out, the more likely it was that I'd be identified, particularly because my office had begun emailing me asking for status updates, and I wasn't answering. But though Glenn and Ewan and Laura were unfailingly sympathetic to my ticking time bomb situation, they never let their desire to serve the truth be tempered by that knowledge. And following their example, neither did I. Journalism, like documentary film, can only reveal so much. It's interesting to think about what a medium is forced to omit, both by convention and technology. In Glenn's prose, especially in The Guardian, you got a laser-focused statement of fact, stripped of the dogged passion that defines his personality. Ewan's prose more fully reflected his character, sincere, gracious, patient, and fair. Meanwhile, Laura, who saw all but was rarely seen, had an omniscient reserve and a sardonic wit, half master spy, half master artist. As the revelations ran wall to wall on every TV channel and website, it became clear that the U.S. government had thrown the whole of its machinery into identifying the source. It was also clear that when they did, they would use the face they found, my face, to evade accountability. Instead of addressing the revelations, they'd impugn the credibility and motives of the leaker. Given the stakes, I had to seize the initiative before it was too late. If I didn't explain my actions and intentions, the government would, in a way that would swing the focus away from its misdeeds. The only hope I had of fighting back was to come forward first and identify myself. I'd give the media just enough personal detail to satisfy their mounting curiosity, with a clear statement that what mattered wasn't me, but rather the subversion of American democracy. Then I'd vanish just as quickly as I'd appeared. That, at least, was the plan. Ewan and I decided that he'd write a story about my IC career, and Laura suggested filming a video statement to appear alongside it in The Guardian. In it, I'd claim direct and sole responsibility as the source behind the reporting on global mass surveillance. But even though Laura had been filming all week, a lot of that footage would make it into her feature documentary, Citizen 4, we just didn't have the time for her to go through everything she'd shot in search of snippets of me speaking coherently and making eye contact. What she proposed instead was my first recorded statement, which she started filming right there and then. The one that begins, my name is Ed Snowden. I'm, 29 years old. Hello, world. While I've never once regretted tugging aside the curtain and revealing my identity, I do wish I had done it with better diction and a better plan in mind for what was next. In truth, I had no plan at all. I hadn't given much thought to answering the questions of what to do once the game was over, mainly because a winning conclusion was always so unlikely. All I'd cared about was getting the facts out into the world. I figured that by putting the documents into the public record, I was essentially putting myself at the public's mercy. No exit strategy could be the only exit strategy because any next step I might have premeditated taking would have run the risk of undermining the disclosures. If I'd made pre-existing arrangements to fly to a specific country and seek asylum, for example, I would have been called a foreign agent of that country. Meanwhile, if I returned to my own country, the best I could hope for was to be arrested upon landing and charged under the Espionage Act. That would have entitled me to a show trial, deprived of any meaningful defense, a sham in which all discussion of the most important facts would be forbidden. The major impediment to justice was a major flaw in the law, a purposeful flaw created by the government. Someone in my position would not even be allowed to argue in court that the disclosures I made to journalists were civically beneficial. Even now, years after the fact, I would not be allowed to argue that the reporting based on my disclosures had caused Congress to change certain laws regarding surveillance, or convinced the courts to strike down a certain mass surveillance program as illegal, or influenced the Attorney General and the President of the United States to admit that the debate over mass surveillance was a crucial one for the public to have, one that would ultimately strengthen the country. All these claims would be deemed not just irrelevant, but inadmissible in the kind of proceedings that I would face were I to head home. The only thing my government would have to prove in court is that I disclosed classified information to journalists, a fact that is not in dispute. This is why anyone who says, I have to come back to the States for trial, is essentially saying, I have to come back to the States for sentencing. And the sentence would, now as then, surely be a cruel one. The penalty for disclosing top-secret documents, whether to foreign spies or domestic journalists, is up to 10 years per document. From the moment that Laura's video of me was posted on the Guardian website on June 9th, I was marked. There was a target on my back. I knew that the institutions I'd shamed would not relent until my head was bagged and my limbs were shackled. And until then, and perhaps even after then, they would harass my loved ones and disparage my character, prying into every aspect of my life and career, seeking information or opportunities for disinformation with which to smear me. I was familiar enough with how this process went, both from having read classified examples of it within the IC and from having studied the cases of other whistleblowers and leakers. I knew the stories of heroes like Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo, and more recent opponents of government secrecy like Thomas Tam, an attorney with the Justice Department's Office of Intelligence Policy and Review, who served as a source for much of the warrantless wiretapping reporting of the mid-2000s. There were also Drake, Binney, Weeb, and Loomis, the digital age successors to Perry Felwock, who back in 1971 had revealed the existence of the then unacknowledged NSA in the press, which caused the Senate's Church Committee, the forerunner of today's Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, to try to ensure that the agency's brief was limited to the gathering of foreign rather than domestic signals intelligence. And then there was U.S. Army Private Chelsea Manning, who, for the crime of exposing America's war crimes, was court-martialed and sentenced to 35 years in prison, of which she served 7, her sentence commuted only after an international outcry arose over the treatment she received during solitary confinement. All of these people, whether they faced prison or not, encountered some sort of backlash, most often severe and derived from the very abuse that I just helped expose. Surveillance. If ever they'd expressed anger in a private communication, they were disgruntled. If they'd ever visited a psychiatrist or a psychologist, or just checked out books on related subjects from a library, they were mentally unsound. If they'd been drunk, even once, they were said to be alcoholics. If they'd had even one extramarital affair, they were said to be sexual deviants. Not a few lost their homes and were bankrupted. It's easier for an institution to tarnish a reputation than to substantively engage with principled dissent. For the IC, it's a matter of consulting the files, amplifying the available evidence, and, where no evidence exists, simply fabricating it. As sure as I was of my government's indignation, I was just as sure of the support of my family and of Lindsay, who I was certain would understand. Perhaps not forgive, but understand the context of my recent behavior. I took comfort from recalling their love. It helped me cope with the fact that there was nothing left for me to do, no further plans in play. I could only extend the belief I had in my family and Lindsay into a perhaps idealistic belief in my fellow citizens, a hope that once they'd been made aware of the full scope of American mass surveillance, they'd mobilize and call for justice. They'd be empowered to seek that justice for themselves, and in the process, my own destiny would be decided. This was the ultimate leap of faith, in a way. I could hardly trust anyone, so I had to trust everyone. Within hours after my Guardian video ran, one of Glenn's regular readers in Hong Kong contacted him and offered to put me in touch with Robert Thibault and Jonathan Mann, two local attorneys who then volunteered to take on my case. These were the men who helped me get out of the Mira when the press finally located me and besieged the hotel. As a diversion, Glenn went out the front lobby door, where he was immediately thronged by the cameras and mics. Meanwhile, I was bundled out of one of the Mira's myriad other exits, which connected via a skybridge to a mall. I like Robert. To have been his client is to be his friend for life. He's an idealist and a crusader, a tireless champion of lost causes. Even more impressive than his lawyering, however, was his creativity in finding safe houses. While journalists were scouring every five-star hotel in Hong Kong, he took me to one of the poorest neighborhoods of the city and introduced me to some of his other clients, a few of the nearly 12,000 forgotten refugees in Hong Kong. Under Chinese pressure, the city has maintained a dismal 1% approval rate for permanent residency status. I wouldn't usually name them, but since they have bravely identified themselves to the press, I will. Vanessa May Bondalian Rodel, from the Philippines. Ajit Push Pakamura, Supan Tilina Kelapata, and Nadika Dilrushki Nones, all from Sri Lanka. These unfailingly kind and generous people came through with charitable grace. The solidarity they showed me was not political, it was human. And I will forever be in their debt. They didn't care who I was or what dangers they might face by helping me, only that there was a person in need. They knew all too well what it meant to be forced into a mad escape from mortal threat, having survived ordeals far in excess of anything I dealt with and hopefully ever will. Torture by the military, rape, and sexual abuse. They let an exhausted stranger into their homes, and when they saw my face on TV, they didn't falter. Instead, they smiled and took the opportunity to reassure me of their hospitality. Though their resources were limited, Supan, Nadika, Vanessa, and two little girls lived in a crumbling, cramped apartment smaller than my room at the Mira, they shared everything they had with me, and they shared it unstintingly, refusing my offers to reimburse them for the cost of taking me in so vociferously that I had to hide money in the room to get them to accept it. They fed me, they let me bathe, they let me sleep, and they protected me. I will never be able to explain what it meant to be given so much by those with so little, to be accepted by them without judgment as I perched in corners like a stray street cat, skimming the Wi-Fi of distant hotels with a special antenna that delighted the children. Their welcome and friendship was a gift. For the world to even have such people is a gift. And so it pains me that, all these years later, the cases of Ajit, Supan, Nadika, and Nadika's daughter are still pending. The admiration I feel for these folks is matched only by the resentment I feel toward the bureaucrats in Hong Kong who continue to deny them the basic dignity of asylum. If folks as fundamentally decent and selfless as these aren't deemed worthy of the protection of the state, it's because the state itself is unworthy. What gives me hope, however, is that just as this book was going to press, Vanessa and her daughter received asylum in Canada. I look forward to the day when I can visit all of my old Hong Kong friends in their new homes, wherever those may be, and we can make happier memories together, in freedom. On June 14th, the U.S. government charged me under the Espionage Act in a sealed complaint, and on June 21st, they formally requested my extradition. I knew it was time to go. It was also my 30th birthday. Just as the U.S. State Department sent its request, my lawyers received a reply to my appeal for assistance from the U.N. High Commissioner on Refugees. There was nothing that could be done for me. The Hong Kong government, under Chinese pressure or not, resisted any U.N. effort at affording me international protection on its territory, and furthermore asserted that it would first have to consider the claims of my country of citizenship. In other words, Hong Kong was telling me to go home and deal with the UN from prison. I wasn't just on my own. I was unwelcome. If I was going to leave freely, I had to leave now. I wiped my four laptops completely clean and destroyed the cryptographic key, which meant that I could no longer access any of the documents, even if compelled. Then I packed the few clothes I had and headed out. There was no safety to be found. in the fragrant harbor.